He is a former congressman from New York, the only practicing CPA ever to be elected to the Congress, a longtime activist on out-of-control spending and of different institutions as well, but especially the federal government. And the federal government is perhaps the foremost example of that. And he's a guy who was poised to really get in there and do some good things, but for the poor judgment of the state of New York. I'll say it because he can't. He's too classy of a guy. I'll be the bad cop. But I'm happy to bring back on the show here Joe DiAguardi to the FDH Lounge. Joe, it's a pleasure to have you back, sir. How are you tonight?
My pleasure, Rick. And Paul's there, too. So you got Rick and Paul tonight.
Yes.
Terrific. Terrific. Well, it's wonderful to be back on. Just a slight correction. I was the first practicing CPA. I think there may be one or two more.
Okay. Yeah, fair enough. That's right. You were the first one there. And it was it's really been a heck of a ride for you since we first had you on, I think, at about this time last year. And this climate, it was really kind of starting to take shape when we had you on the show here. Everything really had kind of launched earlier in 2009 with the Tea Parties, late summer of 2009. You saw the infamous town hall meetings, the people revolting against Obamacare, which would go on to be enacted anyways subsequently here. It was a heck of a ride starting at that time. Weeks later, after we had you on, Scott Brown would shock the world and take Ted Kennedy's seat in the Senate in Massachusetts for the Republicans. What did that, when you saw that happen, did that give you any kind of extra sense of encouragement at the time that this might be necessary in New York, or did you kind of write it off since it was a special election?
No, it did give me the kind of inducement I needed to jump in. And it's a shame, though, that I went all the way to win that primary on September 14th and thinking that that would be the spur that would get the National Party involved and the State Party, but it did not. And money was an important part of the race because the incumbent was appointed by a pretty unpopular governor, Patterson. She was raising money for 2 years, so she had over $10 million bucks waiting, and here I had to spend a lot of money on the primary, only to win it on September 14th and then have less than 6 weeks to win the general election. It was tough.
Oh, it really was. And there was the sense also, too, I don't know if you agree with this or not. My sense in terms of the overall climate was that you might have been a victim of the way that events were unfolding. Scott Brown goes in and wins it. It was a chance, really, for the voters of Massachusetts and a lot of people who don't even traditionally vote Republican and even some who might have hang-ups about doing so to kind of send a message about things they were dissatisfied with. By the time it rolled around in the fall, you won that primary against pretty good odds. The initial polling results for you in the first week or two after that were looking pretty good, but all of a sudden, you started thinking if it's a big enough wave, geez, Joe DiAguardi might be the 51st vote in the Senate for the Republicans. And
yes,
methinks that that might have been a little bit much for some of the persuadables in New York to swallow, maybe.
Well, you know, I approached the people at the National Party. In fact, I even met with Senator Cornyn, and it was obvious that New York State is a very expensive state when it comes to media, especially when you get to the metropolitan area in New York City. And they have preferred to spend that money in West Virginia and other states. So as a result, I kind of went into a gunfight with a knife. And if you remember that picture, I think it was the Untouchables, and it was Sean Connery that said that. After the primary, I win that great primary, the polls are coming together, but I'm only able to raise about another million, and she's sitting there with $10 million. And she's playing, this is Gillibrand, playing her message over and over again, and New York's a big state. So it's not just a question of competence, a question of who's the better candidate. You need to replay the message. I had the message, but I couldn't get it out there enough, especially in that expensive New York media.
Well, the other thing, too, you know, when you're talking about the party and the party establishment and all of that, purely for the point of accuracy, I need to remind everybody here, all of our viewers again, you were not the pick of the poobahs in the establishment there. You know, you beat them in the primary. Nobody asked you to go out there and be the anointed candidate. You beat the anointed candidate and the other guys in the race here, and a lot of times people have long memories when that happens.
Yeah, well, Rick, you know, you're exactly right. I started this race March 16th, 2010 at Grand Central Terminal, and then we had the conventions, that process. I won the conservative convention very handily, 69% plus. The Republican convention, the play-to-pay politicians got involved, and they started to put up their so-called puppets. And they marginalized me to the point where I couldn't get the 25%, which I thought I had. So what I did is what no one else has ever done in New York State. I went back to Main Street, got over 25,000 signatures when you only needed 15,000, got myself into the primary, but that took all summer, diverted me from raising money. I had to use money to do that because you needed to have a pretty good network of people around the state to do it. Then come September 14th, I then decided, hey, you know, I'm so close to winning this. I was favored in the polls. Let me now put some of my money in. So I went into my retirement savings, believe it or not, and managed to pull out some money so I can replay those great ads that I had and won the primary. Now, thank God I did put that money in because one of the contenders supported by the establishment was a multimillionaire who came out of Bear Stearns, and sure enough, as I suspected, he put in a couple of million bucks in the last month. But I beat him by about 5 points, and the other one, the designee of the party, by even more. Now, coming out of all of that energy throughout the summer, and then you can imagine the high winning it on the 14th, the polls are coming together. I now appealed to the state party, the federal party. I sent out all kinds of mailings to raise money, and it didn't work. There was just too much of a distraction from other things going on, and we had someone running at the top of the ticket who was getting himself into trouble, Mr. Palladino. He's a businessman. He wasn't articulate enough in the way he presented himself, and the image of him carrying that bat was, I think, a little bit too much. He wanted to come to Albany with a bat. In fact, to kind of distinguish myself from him, I said, you know, we are different in our styles and our tools. He wants to bring a baseball bat to Albany. I, as a CPA, want to bring a sharp pencil to Washington.
Yeah, you know, it was one of those things, Joe, I was kind of wincing on your behalf every time I'd see the guy on TV and, you know, going through another one of these things here. Even if I agreed with him substantively on some of the things that he was saying, it's all in the presentation.
Yes.
And, you know, these
You're right. And it's a shame because not one of the major seats was taken by a Republican, not the governor, not the attorney general, not the controller, and the two Senate races. And it's a shame that that happened. But we did eke out, just this week, control of the state Senate, which means that there'll at least be someone at the table for the redistricting. But New York State's in terrible shape. I believe in my own heart it's bankrupt already. I don't know whether you saw the article in the Times this Sunday. It's all about the states now, and the title is, I got it in front of me, Mounting Debts by States Stoke Fears of a Crisis. And when you get into the article, Rick and Paul, you see that what they're saying is this could be the next bubble because the states have hidden a lot of their debt, just like the federal government. Don't forget, I ran as a CPA, and I told the people, don't believe the government when it tells you, the federal government, or the Obama administration, or my opponent Gillibrand, that the debt is $14 trillion. That's a lie. That's the bonded debt. You have to add to that what's off the books, and that's Social Security, Medicare, the military pensions, civil service pensions, and these government-sponsored enterprises like Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, Farm Credit System, and you get up to $63 trillion. Now, guess what this article says? That the unfunded, hidden, unrecorded liabilities for pensions in the states are approximately $3.5 trillion. We are heading for a big fiscal iceberg, the federal government and the states. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to get into the Senate, because I know how powerful one senator can be, and I wanted to be that Paul Revere ringing that bell over and over again, waking up America that things are not right and that they're lying to you when it comes to the accounting system, because government, Rick, uses an accounting system, the federal government, that would get you put in jail. You would be indicted. You'd be convicted if you were a publicly traded officer of an officer of a publicly traded corporation through securities fraud if you use the accounting system of the U.S. government. And yet that message still isn't there. Everybody says, Joe, you're right. You wrote a book about it in 92. My new book is coming out this week. As a matter of fact, it's on Amazon.com as we speak. The press release came out yesterday. So I'm not going to stop. I'm going to continue as a former congressman, as the first practicing certified public accountant ever elected to the Congress, House or Senate, to get out there and give this message to the people to wake them up, because we have probably only 5 years to turn this ship around. Otherwise, in 10 years, China's going to be number one, a superpower, and we're going to be behind them.
Well, you know, Joe, I can't help but think, and tie it back to what you said before when you went to spend the money for your campaign ads and you said you tapped into your retirement fund. You know, that was money well spent, because in 5 years, when we're like the Weimar Republic, when we're doing the old wheelbarrow full of cash to go to the supermarket to buy a loaf of bread, you know, what will that money be worth anyways? At least you got some bang for the buck. And let me tell you something. Those were some sweet ads, my friend, because that whole thing that you did with the whole thing about the most expensive credit card in the world, you know, yeah, your card from when you were in Congress. I mean, right, what better visual, what better way to get this through to people to really make that connection?
Yeah, and what's the message, Rick? We're spending money we don't have. We're borrowing from countries like China that we don't trust. They don't share our values. And we're putting the American dream in jeopardy.
Yeah.
That was the message. And that is the message today. Now, what's going to happen in the next Congress? Lord knows. It's a divided Congress. It's going to be tough to see any real policy, especially on the budget, being adopted. You see the differences of opinion already with the debt commission that came out. Although I applaud them for doing their job, we couldn't get 14 votes out of 18 to make it mandatory, so that there's going to be a lot of jawboning now in the next couple of years. But hopefully some of what they said will be implemented, because we're running out of time. We need to get our fiscal house in order to compete. You know, we are basically an unsustainable financial entity right now, and most of the states in the union, especially the big states, are the same. So we do have a crisis. I hope the people are not falling asleep on it, but there are politicians that just want to get reelected, and they put them to sleep with the wrong numbers.
Yeah, and that's a very real problem, Joe, no question about it. And as you look at it here, I want to get your thoughts on something like this. This would have been a little tricky to ask you about during the campaign here, because whatever answer you give me would have been ripe for demagoguing. But I just wrote a column for our blog recently. You know, like you, I was Tea Party before Tea Party was cool or even around or anything like that. So I'm a pretty big tax hawk myself. Don't like them. But I wrote a column on this and said, look, the Republicans have really been the party of borrow and spend. And look, if you're not going to pay for stuff, raise taxes. My first preference is to cut. But if you do not have the testicular fortitude to do that, then you know what? At least have the decency to pay for it. Do you agree with me on that there, that there may be a need somewhere along the line in some areas to raise revenues if they are not going to cut these things back as they should?
Rick, the concept of balancing the budget using all means is a good one, but let me give you the reality. The reality is every time I've seen taxes raised, it was spent for things other than why they were being raised. Let me give you an example. Social Security. There is no trust fund. There's no lockbox. We have had a huge amount of money since 1982 poured in through FICA taxes into the so-called Social Security Trust Fund. What did they do? They just used it to spend on the general fund. So today, you have a huge deficit in the Social Security. In fact, what they are IOUs, they're Treasury bills that were put into the Social Security Trust Fund, approximately $6 trillion. That money now is needed to pay the baby boomers. They want their money. So now we have to find that money someplace. Look at what happened in New York State with the whole issue of the lottery and off-track betting. Where did the money go? Now off-track betting is bankrupt. It never goes to the place where it should be going. This is the problem with raising revenues. So you need to put the emphasis on reducing the size of government, reconfiguring what the federal government should be doing and what the state should be doing. Rick, the federal government did not create the states. The states created the federal government, and yet today 10 states are dependent more than 25% on their direct revenues for their budget from the federal government. You know what that means? And New York is one of them. New York is That's direct. Direct means Medicaid reimbursements and grants. I didn't say contracts that come from the federal government, Social Security checks coming into the state, and things like that. We are in trouble because the federal government is usurping not only the power of the people on Main Street, but it's pushing the states now into being hostages to it. It's got to change. Let me give you a for instance. It came up in the campaign. One reporter said to me, Joe, you were against the stimulus. You were against the this and that. You wanted to cut. You couldn't be against the $600 million that's now going to come into New York State from the federal government for education. I says, ma'am, you're asking me the wrong question. How did the $600 million get to the federal government to begin with? It should have never been sent there. Education should be done by the states. There should be some oversight, but it should be minimal. So the federal government is not doing what the founding fathers thought it was going to do, national security, defense. Today you would say the environment, nuclear energy, things that transcend borders. But things like education should be done by the states. So we have to relook at everything we're doing in order to get the federal government back to the size it should be. And that's one of the problems. And the other problem is that pensions, whether it's military pensions, civil service pensions, Social Security, they don't use the right kind of accounting system, so therefore we never know what the real number is. If you are a publicly traded corporation, Rick, like GE or General Motors, you need an actuary to come in to compute the present value of the liability that you have for workers who have retired and those working today, and you have to use mortality rates. It's easily determined. That's a profession. The federal government is not doing that. So as a result, we're not putting if they do it, they don't put it on the books. It's nowhere to be found. So now we have to figure out what is that money that we need years from now to pay for Social Security. We think we have the number, but it's not on the books, so no one sees it. This is a problem. So as someone said in the Clinton administration, it's the economy, stupid. You know what Joe DiGuardi is going to say, CPA? It's the accounting, stupid. We're not looking for the rules that accountants are trained to use. It's called generally accepted accounting principles. In fact, the Securities and Exchange Commission uses generally accepted accounting principles, and you need independent audits. Rick, there are no independent audits in government. Who can you trust? Look at Moody's and Standard & Poor's. What happened? The people who were evaluating were being paid by the people who they were evaluating. A conflict of interest. It's happening in the federal government. All these accounting agencies, whether it's OMB, CBO, GAO, the Financial Accounting Standard Advisory Board, are all funded by the federal government. Therefore, they give the Treasury the numbers that they want. And the administration controls the Treasury, and the administration wants to be elected again in 2012. So what are the people going to get? They're going to get the numbers that make it look better than what it is.
Yep.
This is a crisis.
Yep. One big conflict of interest there. And actually, your point, too, about raising taxes to cover the spending, you're absolutely right about that as far as how it's gone down every time. Steve Moore of Cato, I think, had a Wall Street Journal column about that the other day. As long as I'm referencing columns here, there was something in the New York Times, and Walter Russell Mead referenced it at the American Interest the other day. I don't know if you had seen this or not. It was something that they had termed Blue State Armageddon. This thing you're talking about with the states here, some of the implications of that column and the subsequent blog column about it indicate that this could be the nastiest social strife coming our way since the Great Depression, maybe even the Civil War. And here's what I mean by that. The states that are the most at risk, New York, Cali, Illinois, et cetera, us red states, we're going to be looking to bail you guys out. That's not going to go down very well. I mean, you are looking at, if people thought that the whole red state, blue state thing was nasty when it was just voting for different candidates and preferring different political philosophies, what happens when the red states have to start dipping into their own pockets to bail out the blue the states? You know, you could get a shooting war coming, and I'm not really exaggerating much.
Well, you know, you're right, because there are some countries like Germany in Europe that are doing a good job, and now they're starting to wince at the fact that they got to bail out Portugal and Ireland and Spain and Greece, and you could see it in the paper just today that Germany's going to go so far and no further. In fact, someone said, you know, this could break the euro. and they may want to go back to the mark. Some are saying that the mark, they're remembering the mark with nostalgia. This could happen in America. You're absolutely right. Some states are doing the right job, and the other states are gaming the system. Why is it that California and New York are basically bankrupt? They're welfare states. You want to come here? As soon as you come in and register, you're entitled to something. You don't have to work for it. This is a problem, and we got to change it. Now we got a new governor. He's a Democrat, and let's see what he does. He's talking the talk. Everything he's saying sounds good. I want to see now if he's going to implement it. But here in this New York Times article, Rick, we have Felix Rohatyn. You remember him?
Yes.
He was the partner at Lazard Frères that was assigned by the Treasury Department to bail out New York City in 1975. How did I get my baptism by fire in government accounting? I was one of the five partners that Arthur Andersen assigned to that account. And here's what Felix is saying here. Quote, "It seems to me that crying wolf is probably a good thing to do at this point," because people are complaining. Oh, everybody's crying wolf, says Felix Rohatyn, the financier who helped save New York City from bankruptcy in the 1970s. So when people say, Joe, oh, you're crying wolf, oh, we've heard it again, hey, someone's got to do it. If Paul Revere didn't ring that bell over and over again, the British were coming, nobody would run. Nobody would know it. Today, everybody wants to keep a lid on the truth when it comes to how bad the federal government's managed and how bad the financial condition is of these states. And I'm so happy to see this article in the New York Times, Sunday, December 5th. My wife cut it out for me. She reads the Times. And here it is. Mounting state debts stoke fears of a crisis. And look at this sentence right here, this paragraph. Much of the debt of states and cities is hidden, since it is off the books, just as the amount of mortgage-related debt turned out to be underestimated. States and municipalities often understate their pension liabilities, in part by using accounting methods that would not be allowed in the private sector. And it goes on and on to explain this. You know, it's right in front of our eyes. The problem is we've distracted the people from seeing clearly the things that they should be understanding today. And the younger generation, we've got them on Facebook. They're all socializing. They're not producing. When people don't sit down to think straight and analyze things and see things whole and are distracted by the celebrity stuff that's going on, by the reality TV shows, by the social media networks, what is that going to say for the next generation? Did you see the report today? Shanghai. All the kids that are coming out of those colleges and graduate schools rank first in the world, not only in the sciences and math, but in the issue of verbal arts. So where are we going as a country when we're not looking at what we need to be competitive, Rick? The key word now for the next 10 years is going to be competition. Are we going to be competitive? Are we going to be productive? Are we going to put the money into R&D to create the technology that kept us in the lead for the last 20, 30, 40 years so we overcame all that waste, fraud, and abuse? Now it seems to me that we're reducing what we spend on R&D. We're letting the Chinese get ahead of us. Worse than that, what we create, they pirate. And we're not strong enough in our protocols with them to make sure that they pay for that. We need leadership. We don't have it right now in Washington. And that's a big problem for the United States of America.
It's a huge problem for the United States of America. And, yeah, this really is a very scary situation here. And again, it's one of these things where in talking to you, you know, it's very stimulating to learn about this kind of stuff from you. I'm kind of a public policy nerd, but I don't know as much about this as you do. So it's good to learn about it. And I know it's good for our viewers to learn about it as well. But I always come away like very deeply depressed as well. Is it too late, Joe? I mean, we've got several decades now of these freebie giveaways of people being, you know, inured to kind of just look for more. From my layman's perspective, I mean, if we reversed course tomorrow and we started doing, you know, cutting to the bone and everything like that, I don't know if it would be enough. Is it too late?
It's not too late. Let me remind you what today is. It's Pearl Harbor, right?
Yep.
December 7th?
Yep.
How did we win World War II? You know, until Pearl Harbor, we didn't have the resolve to jump into this war. And you can be sure we were not that prepared even on December 7th. But how did we do it? We had a leader. His name was FDR. What did he do? He managed to convince the people that this is a shared responsibility, that we need to save America because of its democratic values. And what happened? The women, they went on the Rosie Derivata. They went into the factories. The men risked their lives, and many of them were killed on the lines. People like my father, who were in the food business and much older, they were exempt, but he told me about rationing. You couldn't get certain things unless you had a stamp. Everybody said that they were going to pitch in because we had leadership to convince them this was a shared responsibility and a shared sacrifice. Where is that happening today? You need to now have a leader, and I don't think it's the one that's in Washington right now, that makes that case to the American people that for 30, 40 years we've eaten our seed corn. And now we've got to rebuild the capital of America and maintain our number one position as a superpower because we are a real democracy. China is not. China is still a communist country that represses its people. We don't want them to be number one. So the issue today is how do you make the case to the American people that we all have to share this? You can't have some people wanting to double dip with two pensions. You can't have the cops and the firemen like we have in New York State that put overtime in the last year because it's the last year that determines their pension. So what happens is they make $100,000, they retire on $150,000. That is why these states are going bankrupt. So you got some neighbors that are losing their houses and their jobs. Some neighbors want a double pension, and many of them go get another job through their political contacts, and it's called double dipping because they may be entitled to another pension. This has got to stop. We all have to see that we're in the same boat. I hate to call it the Titanic, but you know what happened when the Titanic went down, Rick?
What?
Even the penthouse deck got wet. Steerage and the penthouse deck both went down with that boat. And that's going to be the United States of America if we don't all work together.
No, you're absolutely right about that. And I know that, again, your new book, which is going to be, I think, a great follow-up to Unaccountable Congress, It Doesn't Add Up. The new one coming out here, talk about that and talk about some of the different policy prescriptions that you have in there.
Okay. The new book is basically a sequel to the old one. Why? Because everything I predicted in 1992 came to pass, including what happened to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And I remember in Chapter 4, and that chapter was built on the bailout of New York City, why it happened. The name of that chapter was the Big Apple and Washington, one bailout after another. I hinted that what happened to New York City could happen to the United States of America, and sure enough, we're on our way. So what I did is I put a 40-page new foreword in that book to show the people what happened between 1992 and 2010 that made it much worse. I even put a 4-page chronology on all the laws that were passed since 1992 so that you could see how step by step we got into the crisis in 2008 and why we're here today. And basically, that book, the message is we have a credit card mentality. We're spending money we don't have. And if we keep doing this, we're going to become a second-rate nation. And I prescribe things as a CPA should in the book. Let me give you, for instance, we have a budget process. You know what that budget process is? One big pot. Throw everything in. We don't care. Offset Social Security surpluses against the rest of the government. Don't even try to define what the government-sponsored enterprises, the GSEs, what their debt is. Throw it in. And at the end of the year, we'll figure out in the budget process how we have to raise the money and do it. No. Guess what my prescription was back in 1992 and it is today? Three separate silos. One is the trust funds. That should not be in the regular budget. That's money that was put there and earmarked. Don't touch that money for something else. That should be its own budget and its own analysis and make a report every year to the people. Number two, government-sponsored enterprises. These are supposed to be self-sufficient enterprises like Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, to promote housing, to facilitate, mortgages being bought and sold and so people can get into housing, which is good public policy. But, hey, with documents, people with jobs, not like they did, they game the system. Then you've got like 20 of them, the post office. You've got the farm credit system, the pension benefit guarantee corporation, where when a company goes bankrupt, they dump the remaining pension that hasn't been funded by the company on the public. These things should be their own separate budget. Don't combine them. And then you have the rest of government. Now, acting like an accountant now. Hey, we spend $500 billion a year on infrastructure assets, $1 billion for an aircraft carrier. Why is that in the budget deficit? Why isn't that put on the books as an asset? In fact, Obama's biggest mistake was his stimulus program. He should have taken a page from FDR and spent $1 trillion on infrastructure 2 years ago. Get the people working. Economists say that there's a 15 to 20% return on the economic fluidity that comes from good infrastructure. It was not done. He just gave a $50 billion program, which is a little bit too little, too late. But why don't we, like the private sector, put assets on the books? Why are we saying that this is part of spending, therefore it's part of the deficit?
Right.
That's not right. So we're not accounting for things the right way. And I'm going to write another book, and the title is probably going to be, It's the Accounting, Stupid. Let's get back to Accounting 101 and put the same rules that the government applies to the private sector through the Securities and Exchange Commission on the government. But guess what? It says it in page 74 of my book. It's one of the many laws that the U.S. government exempted themselves from.
Exactly. And that happens all too often. Joe, we're up against our hard break here, top of the hour. A true pleasure to have you on, sir. And I want to plug also here, too, as far as another talented and famous DiGuardi in the family here, daughter Kara with Going Platinum, new show.
She reinvented herself. She's now going to have a show next year where she's the key judge on judging songwriters. And before I forget, don't forget, if anybody wants to see that book, and I don't own it, it's owned by the foundation, they have to get it on Amazon.com. It's being reprinted on demand by Amazon. The press release came out yesterday. So go on Amazon.com and look for Joe DiGuardi. If you put DiGuardi, you're liable to get Kara.
Better put Joe in there also. Hey, Joe, listen, God bless you for everything that you've done.
Website to see what I've done for 25 years to sound the alarm, to wake up America, okay?
Yep.
It's www.truthingovernment.org. Spell out truthingovernment.org.
We got it linked off of our rundown on the blog here tonight. Joe, always a pleasure, sir. Hope to catch up with you again here sometime soon and see how things are going. Thank you.
Let's do it often.
All right, Joe. We will. Thank you so much, everybody. Former Congressman Joe DiGuardi, everybody, a great American, and I say that without any irony whatsoever. I mean, too good for the voters in New York, man. This guy, you know, the voters want the truth. They can't handle the truth, apparently.